Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys, Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges, working to encourage lawmakers to fund Florida's future through support of public education, online at myuff.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Florida lawmakers move to expand the controversial school guardian program, but insist
the legislature is not arming teachers.
Also tonight, Florida's Constitution Revision Commission could soon go the way of Bonnie Tyler. She's the singer whose last hit record was when the commission issued its first list of recommendations way back in 1978.
There were members of this commission that their sole purpose was to be a proxy vote by those who appointed them. That's where I say, okay, we've gone too far.
And there's lots more ahead as well. I'm Tom Flanagan. It's day four of week three in the 2019 Florida lawmaking session, and this is Capitol Report. Just over a year since the Parkland School massacre, a comprehensive response on how to best prevent a future tragedy remains a work in progress, at least in the Florida legislature. Before a key committee today, the question boiled down to this: would parents be comfortable with placing their children's safety in the hands of an armed teacher with 8 hours of active shooter training? Although some insisted the answer to that question would most likely be no, lawmakers kept moving in that direction, as we hear from Blaze Ganey.
Last year, it was considered a compromise when the legislature decided not to allow classroom teachers to be armed. This year, they want to make it an option. Naples Republican Representative Byron Donalds explains.
The legislature is not arming teachers. The legislature is giving authority to the local school boards to make a decision with respect to security in their districts. And one of those options is the ability to have classroom teachers be a part of this program. That is an option.
Opponents to the idea, like Greta Patenaude, an ESOL teacher in Tampa, say they don't want the option and claim the legislature would be better off focusing on other ways to prevent crimes.
Please look into technology, building infrastructure to mitigate risk. Bulletproof, glass, auto-locking doors, smart badges. These are all ideas for my students. Army teachers who are on the clock to teach, not in protection attack mode, place us and our students at increased risk of being killed.
Beverly Hills Republican Representative Ralph Masullo pushed back.
Do you have any evidence that arming individuals that volunteer, that go through a selection process mentally, physically, and training to be properly armed and use firearms correctly, have created any danger in schools in Florida?
Scott McCoy of the Southern Poverty Law Center says there is no evidence supporting either side.
I cannot tell you that there is an example where a guardian has shot a kid at school, right? But I also can't find any evidence that says that a guardian in a school has prevented a shooter from coming in and killing one in the school.
Eustace Republican Representative Jennifer Sullivan argues there is info that shows the program here in Florida works.
25 districts who have put the program in place. Now we're several months into the school year. We have 743 guardians, and there has not been a parade of horribles that have happened. You know, the what if that I want to know is, what if Coach Aaron Feist was armed? What if he hadn't had to use his own body as a means of defending students? What if then?
Representative Donalds believes the current program works fine and that expanding it to teachers would not result in the hypotheticals some describe. He says the 144 hours of training requirements will prepare teachers to handle these situations.
80 hours of commission-certified firearm training. This is starting in line 125 of the bill. 16 hours of instruction in a precision pistol. 8 hours of discretionary shooting instruction using state-of-the-art simulator exercises. 8 hours of instruction in active shooter or assailant scenarios. 8 hours of instruction in defensive tactics. 12 hours of instruction in legal issues. 12 hours of certified nationally recognized diversity training program.
But the League of Women Voters' Nicolette Stringer believes that time needs to be drastically increased.
Only eight of those 144 hours are for active training shooter or active shooter training. 8 hours. That's one day. One day, and we're expecting our teachers to then have a gun and protect their children in the classroom.
Meanwhile, the Tampa ESOL teacher doesn't want teachers armed for other reasons.
I don't want the other teachers looking at my black, brown, Muslim students, whatever other is, and they're not constantly being trained for this.
She says she knows there are racists in this society and doesn't doubt some are teachers. That drew a rebuke from Jacksonville Republican Representative Cord Byrd.
Representative Fine asked my question that for the speaker to point out the racist colleagues she has, because I'm not aware of any teachers that I know that exhibit those racist behaviors.
But some aren't worried about racism, undertrained teachers, or hypotheticals. They are worried about simply being and living in a space where they are not comfortable. The League's Nicolette Springer again.
But it's not voluntary for the teachers who live in the districts who's decided to arm the teachers, because they don't get to voluntarily move. They don't get to voluntarily go to another district and decide, and just because they want to move into a district that doesn't arm teachers. If you live in that district that arms teachers, those teachers are now forced to work in a school where there are going to be guns.
Representative Donalds believes that most of the worry is that armed teachers will not be trained and will cause harm to those around them. He says that's mostly emotion talking, and that the recommendation made today was one drawn from facts.
The Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Commission, its purpose is to get out of the heart-wrenching, the tragic emotion of what happened on Valentine's Day last year and get to the facts of what actually happened, where the failures were, and what the recommendations are to try to prevent another tragedy like what happened at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. Those are the facts.
In the end, the vote fell on an 11-5 party line split, and out of all public testimony, not one was in support of the idea of arming teachers. I'm Blaze Ganey.
State lawmakers appear heading toward abolishing the state's Constitution Revision Commission. This after the latest incarnation of the group was roundly criticized for being overtly political. Lynn Hatter reports the effort has generated a rare point of bipartisanship between lawmakers and advocacy groups who don't normally agree on anything.
What does the National Organization for Women and the free market think tank Americans for Prosperity have in common? Both say get rid of the Constitution Revision Commission.
So here's what I think. I think we've gone from a committee of our peer or a committee of citizens that could get together every 20 years and look to see if there were places where revisions needed to be made. But now we've gone to a super political committee.
That's Representative Brad Drake. The North Florida Republican calls the CRC the Crony Committee. Members are appointed by the governor, House and Senate leaders, and the head of the Florida Supreme Court. Drake says members of the last commission did voters a disservice.
And in fact, we saw this last cycle that there were members of this commission that their sole purpose was to be a proxy vote by those who appointed them. That's where I say, okay, we've gone too far.
The CRC ended up putting 7 amendments before voters in November. Some were grouped together in what the commission said was an attempt to avoid ballot fatigue. Critics saw those combinations as an attempt to trick voters into passing unpopular ideas. The Leroy Collins Center, a policy think tank, says it would rather the commission be amended, not abolished. During an interview last year, Center Director Carol Weissert called the bundled amendments a little bit of a reach, and she questioned whether most of them even belonged in the state's governing document. Take one amendment that granted expanded survivor benefits to first responders, coupled with tuition issues at the state's universities, and put the Florida college system into the state's constitution.
I can't remember why what the rationale was, sort of survivor benefits with public colleges and universities. But that's one where I think it's, you might have a little, people might say, well, I certainly support survivor benefits, but what is this going to do to universities? Or are they just going to say, okay, survivor benefits, I'm for this.
I was frustrated and disappointed, candidly, with the outcome of the most recent Constitution Revision Commission.
That's St. Petersburg Democratic Representative Ben Diamond. He agrees the last CRC went too far with bundled amendments and also questions the group's decision-making. But he's not sure whether to throw it out.
And even though I wasn't enamored by some of the work of this most recent CRC, the CRC provides a forum for us to think about big questions in terms of the structure of government. You know, how are we going to reorganize our state cabinet? And I think back of prior revision commissions, like the one chaired by Sandy Dallenbert and Dexter Douglas, and I felt like they were trying to address those types of bigger issues. That's the appropriate role for that commission, in my perspective.
The 1997-98 commission is often held up as an example of good governance. The first formal CRC meeting took place in 1977 and 20 years later in 1997. The most recent version began meeting in 2017. But after 60 years and three different commissions, Democratic Representative Steve Geller wants it gone.
Up on the bill, we got 19 years to come up with something else.
The Senate feels similarly, and a companion bill to abolish the CRC could soon be up for a full chamber vote. The voices favoring abolishing the Constitution Revision Commission appear louder than those trying to save it. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Still to come on Capitol Report. Lawmakers say they're motivated to help people exhibiting mental illness get treatment sooner.
Inadequate and delayed treatment takes a heavy toll on individuals and family, costing our economy an estimated $156 billion a year.
Kids on the autism spectrum who are on Medicaid could be shunted onto long wait lists or even denied care altogether because of new credentialing requirements the state is demanding of providers.
I don't want that to be our bread and butter anymore because you just never know what's going to happen.
And a longtime Capitol lobbyist and advocate finds herself, for the first time ever, booted out of a committee hearing, and she's not happy about it.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
Florida lawmakers say they're making mental health care a priority, especially in the aftermath of the Parkland school shooting last year. Part of that effort includes early detection of mental health issues and providing support through peer specialists. Regan McCarthy has more.
For St. Augustine Republican Representative Cindy Stevenson, early intervention for mental health concerns can be an emotional issue.
I have had so many people come and talk to me about this when I joined the legislature. People whose families were really challenged in an unexpected time. And when I started to learn about this,
take your time.
I was just so excited.
Stevenson isn't the only one who teared up in a recent House Children, Families, and Seniors Committee meeting.
Vice Chair Stevenson, I'm upset with you.
Oh.
I almost made it through one committee without crying. It seems that this committee can always bring that out. I want to congratulate you on this bill, and thank you. I have a personal connection to this and a family history of it.
That's Democratic Representative Cindy Polo. She says had her family members' mental illness been caught when they were younger, the outcome could have been very different. That's what Stevenson is hoping too.
Inadequate and delayed treatment takes a heavy toll on individuals and family, costing our economy an estimated $156 billion a year. This is not a large segment of our population, only about 3%. Roughly 100,000 youth and young adults a year experience psychosis.
Stevenson says early intervention results in more effective treatment and a greater likelihood of personal success. Her bill encourages the use of first episode psychosis programs. Those are programs that provide collaborative care for case management, psychotherapy, medication, and family support. Stevenson's measure also paves the way for mental health treatment facilities to hire peer specialists. Those are people who've been through treatment themselves and provide support for people as they work toward recovery.
Studies have shown us that the use of peer specialists is beneficial to people in recovery from mental illness and substance use disorder.
Stevenson's bill piggybacks on another measure moving through the legislature that lets organizations hire peer specialists even if they have a criminal history. That bill is awaiting a vote on the House floor. It's sponsored by Boca Raton Republican Representative Mike Caruso. But Caruso says hiring a peer specialist is difficult because it's not unusual for a person to commit a lower-level crime in connection to their addiction or mental illness.
This bill expands the types of low-level nonviolent crimes that qualify as exemptions for persons working solely in mental health and addiction programs for those over 18 only. These include theft, prostitution, bad checks, low-level possession charges, where the crime is committed and sentences were completed over 5 years ago.
Caruso and Stevenson say besides helping people currently in recovery, the legislation could help people who've already received treatment and might otherwise be having a difficult time finding work. Similar legislation is moving forward in the Senate. I'm Regan McCarthy.
While we're on the subject, children on the autism spectrum who are also on Medicaid may find themselves waiting longer for or even being denied altogether the special services they depend on. We get that story from Health News Florida's Delena Miller.
About 41,000 children statewide receive Applied Behavior Analysis Therapy, or ABA, through the Florida Medicaid system. It helps children on the autism spectrum work on skills like hand washing and going to the bathroom, as well as combating maladaptive behaviors like screaming, biting, and headbanging. But the state is making provider credentialing difficult, and in some cases is retracting the credentials for a position called a Registered Behavior Tech, or RBT, even if the agency previously approved their paperwork. Some clinics say they're no longer able to serve some children because these techs are the backbone of their practice.
Without your RBTs, you don't have an agency.
That's Angie Smith, the owner of Amazing Gains Behavior Therapy Services in Orlando. She says that on December 1st, the State Agency for Healthcare Administration, or ACA, emailed providers telling them they had 4 weeks to provide the paperwork proving all their techs are credentialed.
Within 2 weeks, we had compiled everything, put it in order, had it submitted well before the deadline. On December 21st, Medicaid made the decision to suspend 100% of our technicians anyway.
Angie Smith's not alone. Numerous clinics on a private Facebook forum for ABA providers complained about the same thing. And while ACA has said in the past that no child has lost services, some, like Florida Association for Behavior Analysis founder John Bailey, disagree.
No, it's not the least bit true.
Bailey said his organization put a call out to their members about denials, and the names came flooding in. He says those names were given to ACA.
They cherry-picked on those names and put them to the top of the list so they could say, oh, well, no, those people are receiving services.
ACA has a moratorium on new providers in Broward and Miami-Dade counties until May because of the fraud investigations. But Angie Smith says children across the state are still sitting on wait lists while clinics grapple with getting new techs credentialed in other parts of Florida.
It's the kids that end up suffering from that, and they can say that it doesn't affect them all they want, but anybody that's in this field knows that that's a completely inaccurate statement.
Angie Smith says when you call ACA to clarify credentialing information, you get 10 different answers from 10 different people. And when you submit paperwork, it's often bounced back to the clinic with a request for information that has already been provided.
Sometimes we get lucky and they go straight through. We complete the same exact paperwork for the next staff and they kick it back 30 times. And that's not an exaggeration, like sometimes that happens.
ACA says it processes applications in the order in which they are received and that there's no backlog. But those in the field, like Adrian Smith at Creative Behavior Solutions in Largo, says that's not the case.
And because it's a struggle for new techs to get credentialed, she says larger companies are luring some away from smaller clinics with pay way beyond the industry average of $15 to $20 an hour.
The highest we've seen is a salary for $95,000, which doesn't make sense.
On top of that, clinics aren't entirely convinced fraud won't continue to find a way. These techs cannot see what hours have been billed under their numbers in the Medicaid portal, opening the door for current or past employers to file for therapy they didn't do. For now, some providers, like Angie Smith, are considering giving up on Medicaid altogether.
I don't want that to be our bread and butter anymore, because you just never know what's going to happen.
And with providers like her dropping out of the state Medicaid program, that can mean even longer wait lists and more communities where providers only serve children with private insurance. For Health News Florida, I'm Delina Miller.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, there are certain fixtures around the Florida Capitol. The soaring stainless steel dolphins in the fountain at the west entrance, the big bronze seals on the fourth floor doors of the House and Senate chambers, and seemingly ubiquitous advocate for progressive causes, Barbara DeVane. Longtime lobbyist and familiar face in the Capitol, DeVane has seemingly seen it all during the decade she spent in the process. But until this week, DeVane says she's never been asked to leave a committee meeting. Ryan Daly recently spoke with DeVane about an exchange with a legislator that led to her being asked to leave.
On Tuesday, a bill requiring minors to get parental consent before having an abortion was in the House Health Quality Subcommittee. Much of the public testimony was emotional, but it was an assertion by Republican Representative Jennifer Sullivan that prompted lobbyist Barbara DeVane to speak out, breaking decorum rules. Committee Chairwoman Colleen Burton then demanded DeVane leave.
The majority of opposition we've heard today is from those who stand to financially benefit from these children moving forward with this procedure. Now, if parent...
Excuse me, ma'am, I'm going to have to ask you to leave the committee room. Excuse me, Sergeant, please remove the woman who's speaking from our room, from the committee room.
I caught up with DeVane on Thursday and asked her to recount the experience.
Here with Barbara DeVane, longtime lobbyist in the Florida Capitol. Just kind of tell me the basics of what happened the other day. Was that Wednesday?
Tuesday. It was Tuesday, which was a very packed day for me because I'm the lobbyist for Florida Now, the National Organization for Women. And it was a really busy day because I have over 30 bills to follow, to testify on. I was scurrying around, so I, of course, went to the meeting on the parental consent bill. That was the bill in question here. We already have parental notification in this state where you have to notify the parent. But now they want to make it even harder for a young woman who is a minor to get an abortion. What they don't take into consideration is, one, most minors, children, do consult with their parents. But there are some instances where they're scared to, or they're ashamed to. We know case after case where young women have been raped by their father, their stepfather, their cousin, their brother. And so a lot of times they aren't even believed, and possibly they could be harmed by reporting this to their parents, talking to their parents about this. So, of course, Florida Now opposes this bill. But what happened with me was, after all the testimony on both sides, and there were a lot of young women who opposed it, a lot of groups, a lot of individuals. And then the chair, she ran a very good meeting up until this point.
And who chairs that committee?
Colleen Burton from Polk County. So she ran a good meeting, except she admonished us not to make a lot of noise and clapping and that sort of thing, which there was none of that going on. And don't roll your eyes. I've never heard that one before. And then there comes a time in the process when you have debate from the members of the committee. Representative Jennifer Sullivan started off her debate with saying, most of the people in the audience who testified against this bill profit from young women having abortions. Not true. I certainly don't profit. Those young women don't profit. Legal women voters, you know, on and on and on. So I stood up in the back of the room and I said, this is not true. And of course, the chair said, sit down, you got to be quiet. And I'm like, well, then you should make or ask the members of the committee not to make disparaging, untrue remarks in debate. She called the sergeant at arms to get me out of the room. Of course, I told him I could get out by myself, but he came anyway. So that's what happened.
And so I understand that this is the first time that's ever happened to you?
Yes, in like the 46, 47 sessions that I've been involved in the legislative process, that's never happened to me before. And I know I broke the rule because I'm not on the committee to debate the bill. However, we can no longer allow legislators to intimidate, harass, and belittle people, taxpaying citizens, who are coming before them. It's their job to listen to us, and it's their job to tell the truth, not to lie in a committee.
As someone who's been around the Capitol for so long, do you see any difference today in interactions during committees or and such between the public and legislators from, you know, back in the day?
Yes. It's gotten worse and worse every session. I never say things can't get any worse up here, because if you say that, they do. But this is one of the worst sessions ever. I call it the session from hell, because there are certain Republican, mostly men, on every committee. I don't know if they go in a room and decide who's going to be the bully, but they are bullying, harassing, and intimidating people who come before the committees. And it's a disgusting sight. I mean, you can disagree without being disagreeable. And it's their job. They are elected to listen to the people, to represent the people.
That's Ryan Daly talking with longtime Capitol advocate and lobbyist Barbara Devane. Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. We also thank Health News Florida's Daylena Miller. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again every weeknight throughout the Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capitol Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys, Florida's advocates for seniors and persons with disabilities. Academy of Florida Elder Law Attorneys. More information about AFELA's policies at afela.org. And from the United Faculty of Florida, representing over 20,000 faculty, staff professionals, and graduate assistants at 13 universities and 14 colleges. Advocates for quality higher education for all Floridians. Online at myuff.org.